Second Peter chapter 2. And reading from verse 1 to the verse 10. The scripture reads, "But there were false prophets also among the people, even as there shall be false teachers among you, who privily shall bring in damnable heresies, even denying the Lord that bought them, and bring upon themselves swift destruction. And many shall follow their pernicious ways, by reason of whom the way of truth shall be evil spoken of. And through covetousness shall they with feigned words make merchandise of you, whose judgment now of a long time lingereth not, and their damnation slumbereth not. For if God spared not the angels that sinned, but cast them down to hell, and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved unto judgment, and spared not the old world, but saved Noah, the eighth person, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood upon the world of the ungodly, and turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemned them with an overthrow, making them an ensample unto those that after should live godly, and delivered just law, vexed with the filthy conversation of the wicked. For that righteous man dwelling among them, and seeing and hearing, vexed his righteous soul from day to day with their unlawful deeds. The Lord knoweth how to deliver the godly out of temptations, and to reserve the unjust unto the day of judgment to be punished. But chiefly them that walk after the flesh, in the lust of uncleanness, and despise government. Presumptuous are they, self-willed, they are not afraid to speak evil of dignities." And thus far we read the word of the Lord. 2 Peter chapter 2, and we're looking this evening at verses 4 to 10, under the theme, "Your Christian witness matters." Your Christian witness matters. In light of verses 1 to 3, where he has dealt with the existence of false teachers, false teachings, the Christian might be tempted to say, given all these problems, given all that Christians have to face, why doesn't God gather all his people in one place so that they would not have to face all this, and would they not also be an encouragement to one another? Why doesn't God just put them all in one corner and say, that little corner is yours, and you can live out your existence? Peter answers that in essence by telling us two things, as are recorded in verse 9 and the first part of verse 10. The Lord knoweth how to deliver the godly out of temptations, and to reserve the unjust unto the day of judgment to be punished, but chiefly them that walk after the flesh in the lust of uncleanness and despise government. This is why God does not gather all of his people in one place across all the world. Because God knows how to look after his people. And he also knows how to deal with the ungodly. And in light of verses 1 to 3, he tells us in verse 10, "But chiefly them that walk after the flesh, and the lust of uncleanness." Now verses 4 to 10, we should note, is just one long sentence in the original, and that is indicated in our English with the series of colons and semicolons, and you get a full stop at the end of verse 10. So it's one long sentence. And in this one long sentence, he gives us three examples of judgment and two examples of deliverance, all of which proves his basic point in verse 9. The Lord knoweth how to deliver the godly out of temptations, and to reserve the unjust unto the day of judgment. And as I said, all this has particular reference to false teachers in verse 10a, which is a summary of verses 1 to 3. So you may be asking then, after all of that, well, that's all very nice, it's interesting, and there's a lot there, I'm sure, but what relevance has it to me as a Christian, where I am and my situation and the life that I have to live, the circumstances in which God has placed me? What is the particular relevance of all of this to me? Why did Peter write all this to these Christians who were evidently experiencing hardship? Well, he wrote it all, not only for them, but for all of God's people as they live in this world. And there are three important truths here in these verses that we ought to notice. Firstly, the certainty of judgment. The whole section from verses 4 to 10 is filled with this truth of judgment. Judgment on the angels in verse 4, judgment on the old world in verse 5, and judgment on Sodom in verse 6, and finally, judgment on the unjust on the day of judgment in verse 9. Notice also Peter's language as he describes all of this. The objects of judgment are described as follows. Verse 4, the angels that sinned. In verse 5, the world of the ungodly. In verse 7, the wicked. And in verse 8, their unlawful deeds. You see, the lesson that Peter wants us to draw from all of these examples is that false teachers in this world that the church and Christians have to battle with will certainly be dealt with. This is why they do not need all to be gathered in one place. They will all be dealt with. In verse 9, he tells us that he reserves the unjust unto the day of judgment to be punished. And that little word reserve that he repeats in verse 17, it's the idea of not escaping the judgment of God, not escaping. There will be no accidents. There will be none missed. No one shall escape the judgment of God. And notice also that it is God who does all of this. It is God who's doing it. In verse 4, it is God who cast them down to hell. It is God who delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved unto judgment. God did this. In verse 5, it is God who spared not. It is God who brought in the flood. God did it. This was not an accident. This was not the laws of nature taking over. God did it. In other words, God is active in all these things. And in verse 6, it is God who turned the cities into ashes. God did it. God turned Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes. And it's pretty powerful language. He reduced them to ashes. He burned them to ashes. Nothing left but cinders. So it is God then, in verse 9, who shall execute judgment on the day of judgment. And singling out in particular, verse 10, in particular, singling out false teachers, but chiefly them, false teachers, particularly singled out for judgment. The bottom line for Christians, as we live in this world, is that God judges. God is a God of wrath. We believe in heaven and we believe in hell. And we believe that God is a God of wrath. No matter what the old liberals, the modernists, and everybody else wants to believe. We believe what the Bible tells us. And the Bible tells us that in all of these verses, God, 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 and God did all of this. He judged the angels. He cast them into hell. He has put them in irons. And he holds them there until the day of judgment. And it is God who burned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. And it is God who sent the flood upon the old world. And it is God who will judge these false teachers. And that leads me to the second point. The importance of individuals. The importance of individuals. When everything has gone to rot, when a whole culture has been overthrown and degenerated into wickedness and lawlessness, the temptation for Christians is to shrug their shoulders in despair and to say, well, the world has gone to pot, our culture has gone to rot, and there's nothing I can do about it. That's the temptation. What can I do when the whole culture is against me? The temptation is to withdraw into isolation. And as a collection of individuals when we meet, to get into a little holy huddle and to comfort ourselves and to applaud ourselves and to slap each other on the back, well, we are surviving. Well, that is not the position. It is not the position. It is a big mistake. As a culture and society grows more wicked and more lawless, it becomes ever more important for individual Christians to take their stand. And this is why Peter singles out two individuals, Noah and Lot. They are here for a reason. Because remember, it's a community in conflict. And as, and at various times in history, the cause of Christ seems small. In the face of a culture, a nation, a city-state that is wicked and ugly and evil. Look at the situations that these men were placed in. Noah, we are all familiar with his position. Noah amidst a world of sin. Think of it. He stood alone in a world of sin. What the whole situation was like, you may read in Genesis 6. Where you see a whole society crumbling, full of lawlessness and wickedness. And there was Noah. The other is Lot. Lot amidst a society of sin. And what it was like for him. You can read all about it in Genesis 18 and 19. And those who are familiar with scripture, you don't need me to go over all those horrible details of what it was like for Lot to live in Sodom. And what it was like in Sodom, it was the same in Gomorrah and all the cities of the plain. A whole culture taken over. But Peter tells us what it was like for them. He tells us how they lived and how they reacted to their circumstances. And we notice four things. Firstly, we learn there will be times when Christians find themselves standing alone. There will be times when Christians find themselves standing alone. Go through church history and you will find this. Yes, sometimes the cause of Christ is popular. Multitudes swept into the kingdom. It's easy to be a Christian in such an age. But church history is littered with those heroes who stood alone. Athanasius, did he not stand alone? When all the world, yes, the whole empire, and that supposedly professing Christian church had embraced a false view of God, and Athanasius, against the world, stood alone to defend the doctrine of the Trinity. And how often he found himself banished and persecuted and chased. But he still stood. And before him, one man defied an emperor. His name was Ambrose. How often he had to flee to save his skin as the emperor sent soldiers to arrest him. He defied an emperor. And he did it alone because he was faithful to the gospel. So here we have these two men, Noah versus the world. In fact, he is said to be the eighth, reminding us that only eight were preserved and in the ark. And as the parallel puts it, there were few that were saved. Noah against the world. Sometimes Christians have been in that situation. And we are heading for that situation, are we not? In this country. And then we have Lot in the cities of the plain. Remember Abraham's prayer? He started with 50. And he went to 40. And then he said, God, if there are 10, will you spare? And God said, yes. And he burned the cities, but there weren't even 10. Think of it. All those cities destroyed. For in none of them was 10 righteous people. And in the one in which Lot lived, there were not 10. They were all destroyed. What a difficult situation for these men. They found themselves alone. How often Christians find themselves alone, even in the workplace, in their callings. They stand alone. There will be times when Christians find themselves standing alone. Secondly, the Christian must be faithful, even when alone. So we read that Noah bore witness, a preacher of righteousness. By his laboring to build the ark, he was preparing for judgment to come, and he remained faithful to that calling and duty, no matter how long it took to complete the task. He was undeterred, though it took a long time. A long time. What perseverance. What endurance. No doubt his sanity was questioned. No doubt his intelligence was questioned. We thought that you were an intelligent person. We thought you were sane and rational. But when we see you building this ark, without any evidence from the world of science, without any evidence from the world of nature, you're crazy. Nobody else believes what you believe. Nobody else is helping you build that ark. Nobody else is standing beside you. The whole world is against you. Noah, and being faithful to his duty, he persevered, though it all seemed so silly. And there are times Christians are made out to be silly. Why bring all this trouble upon yourself? All this trouble for a doctrine, for a truth that God is going to judge. We cannot see it. Don't be silly. Like Noah, the Christian must be faithful, even when alone. And thirdly, the Christian will be severely tested by the wickedness of others. The Christian will be severely tested by the wickedness of others. And this is well illustrated by Lot. In turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemned them with an overthrow, making them an ensample unto those that after should live ungodly, and deliver just Lot, vexed with the filthy conversation of the wicked, for that righteous man dwelling among them, and seeing and hearing, vexed his righteous soul from day to day with their unlawful deeds. Verse 7 uses the word vexed. It's put in a present passive tense to indicate to us, the reader, that it was constant. There was no let up. He was being driven to exhaustion by it all. He was being oppressed by it all. The whole situation exhausted him, because it was coming to him and upon him and against him. He was the recipient of it all. He was the target. He was the focus. And it was relentless, day after day, no let up. And in verse 8, we have the word vexed, different word, but again, rightly translated vexed, it means to be tormented and pain, as it is so translated, for example, in Revelation 20. Verse 10, the devil that deceived them and so on shall be tormented day and night forever. So here was this poor man in this terrible city, a culture of such vileness and wickedness. And he was under unrelenting pressure. He was tormented, pained, depressed, vexed day after day. How oppressive the situation. But some might raise an objection. They might say that Lot was in no position to do anything. After all, what right had he to speak? Hadn't he, as it were, blotted his copybook? Well, we mustn't conclude that because Lot was imperfect, and he was. And we mustn't conclude that because he made a wrong decision, that it therefore invalidated his stance against the society and the culture in which he stood. Some people would do that. They would say, Lot, well, we know what he did. Therefore, they mean, we can dismiss anything he said. That there is no validity at all in anything that he says. Well, I'm glad Lot is not judged by our fellow man, but judged by God. And Peter three times calls him righteous. Righteous. First use is in verse 7, just. And twice in verse 8, he's called righteous. The point is, we do not look for perfection in the servants or tools that God uses. And when you go down through church history, and you read carefully the lives of all those who stand out, they were all imperfect people. Every single one of them. They all had their flaws. They all had their mistakes and problems. But Peter overlooks the folly of Lot, which led him to live in Sodom. He shouldn't have been there, but there he is nonetheless. And what Peter emphasizes is the conduct of Lot in that situation. What an encouragement. The conduct of Lot. He tells us that Lot was severely tested. So Christians will be severely tested by the culture and society in which they live when it is wicked. They will be severely tested. And are these not testing times in which we live? We have a very powerful lobby of sorts from a certain section of the community. Dare anyone critique them and call their practices sinful? They're up in arms. The Christian will be severely tested by the wickedness of others. And the fourth thing we learn is the faithful Christian will be the one who stands out in a corrupt society. The faithful Christian is the one who will stand out in a corrupt society. You see, the one who professes to be a follower of Christ, but he wants to accommodate himself to the prevailing culture, he or she is not the one who stands out. The one who accommodates themselves to the world and to the culture in which we live will never stand out. Oh, the world will applaud them. And the world will say, this is a fine Christian. Why aren't all Christians like that Christian? Instead of being awkward and difficult as you are. Look again at these men. Why do they stand apart? Why? Why do they stand apart? Why are they singled out? Are they singled out because they sided with the world? Because they caved in? Not at all. They are singled out because they sided with God and not the society of men. And you in your calling, or in whatever place God has put you, whatever your duties are, you will be singled out and stand out the more you stand for God. Now, it is not that they deliberately stood out. There are some people, you know, and they think they're being persecuted because of their faithfulness, but the only reason they're being persecuted is because they're just downright awkward. At every turn, they're just awkward. And there are some that are like that. And yes, we accept that they're Christians and they're truly saved. But you know, there's an awkwardness about them. Just plain awkward. That's not why these men stood out. Rather, it was their difference with culture and society that made them stand out. All the culture was going in one direction. Because it was going in the wrong direction, because it was going in the opposite direction from the authoritative law of God, these people said, we will not travel that road with you. So Luther stood out against the corruption and abuse of Catholicism. He wanted the issue debated. This is an issue that should be debated in the universities. The whole culture in which we live, the whole culture that Rome has spawned, all the theology it underpins, this is a serious issue. He stood out, didn't he? as we all know. Now, when they do stand out, they will endure hard times. It will be difficult. All kinds of pressure will be brought to bear. First, it comes in the form of advice for your good, we will be told. You know, we just want to help you. We don't want you to lose out. In any way, we just want to help you. And our advice to you is, forget loyalty to Christ. Go with the flow. But then, if you are stubborn, well, faithful would be the better word. They will say, now you are being awkward. And then they will argue with you. And then finally, they will bring sanctions upon you. The word Puritan was once a term of abuse. Now, of course, all conservative Christians want to wear it as a badge of honour. We'd nearly print it on a t-shirt, wouldn't we? Or wear it on a lapel. We think it's wonderful. But it wasn't wonderful when it was first coined. It was costly. The word Puritan meant somebody who was a narrow-minded sectarian bigot who could not be tolerated in decent society, nor fit to either hold a job or hold office. What really irks is the fact that these people refuse to follow the world. They will sail into the wind as opposed to bowing to the wind and going with it. This didn't make Noah or Lot hermits or monks. They didn't say, well, the pomp of the world, and here I am having all these problems, I'm just going to go home, shut the door, forget about everything. Just be a hermit, a monk, get in that monastery or whatever. No, they said no to the culture, the society in which they lived, and whatever the consequences, they stood out. They were singled out. That leads me to the third point, verses 9 and 10, the reality of sovereignty. The Lord knoweth how to deliver the godly out of temptations and so on. Peter's objective in this section is now to encourage Christians. He has talked of judgment and judgment to come. He has spoken of the importance of the individual standing faithfully for Christ and the claims of God upon their lives. And now he underpins the whole thing with the sovereignty of God. Few doctrines, I think, achieve this more in terms of encouragement as the sovereignty of God does. The one thing that strikes us in this whole section from verses 4 to 10 is the ruling of God over everything. And we see it in three ways. Firstly, there is the power of God. There is the power of God. He casts the fallen angels into hell. He drowns the world in a flood. He turns Sodom into ashes. In other words, God restrains wickedness. He limits the extent of wickedness. That is power being exercised in this world. He restrains and limits the extent of sin and evil. Any idea that the devil's in charge is foreign entirely to Peter's theology, and indeed all the theology of Scripture. What encouragement is it to the believer to stand firm where you are if the devil's in charge? How could you leave your home? How could you venture out into the public square? How could you face your accusers if they call you into their office and say, we have something we want to say? You would go in there, fear and trembling. So, oh dear, the devil's in control, and I have no help. Not at all. Peter says, God's in charge. And as long as heaven and hell exists, God's in control. The power of God. He casts the angels that fell into hell. He drowns the world in a flood. He burns the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. The power of God's sovereignty. But the second aspect is the character of God himself. Whatever the view our society and culture takes of sin, whatever view they have of Sodom and Gomorrah and all its practices, God's character doesn't change. And God judges in terms of righteousness. Look again at these verses. Verse 4. The angels that sinned. Verse 5. The world of the ungodly. Verse 7, the filthy conversation of the wicked. And verse 8, their unlawful deeds. Now our culture will take an entirely different view of the angels that fell, of the old world before the flood, and of Sodom and Gomorrah. Our world and culture will take a different view. They will applaud the initiative and independence of the angels. They will approve of the alternative lifestyle of Sodom and Gomorrah. They will approve of the forward thinking of the old world. That's what our culture will do. As if somehow or other the standards have changed. And ultimately that God himself has changed. Peter says no. Peter tells us God judges them all in righteousness. Significantly, the lifestyle of Sodom and Gomorrah is termed unlawful. Unlawful. In other words, there is a standard of right and wrong, and by that standard, they were in the wrong. And who set that standard? God did. The standard is the transcript of his righteousness. So there is the character of God. It doesn't change. There's the power of God. Never diminishes. But there's one third thing. There's the mercy of God. God has his eye on the righteous. He tells us, the Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptations. The mercy of God. The kindness of God. He knows how to deliver them. Now Peter doesn't say it. He will deliver them. He will always deliver them. But he knows what he's doing in relation to the godly. He knows exactly what he's doing. Remember those Hebrews? When they were faced with punishment, they said, well, whether you throw us in or not, and punish us or not, God is able to deliver us. But if he doesn't deliver us, that's not because he's not able. It's because it pleases him not to. So we have absolutely no pangs of conscience about what we're doing. We're standing firm for God. We know what our God is like. And if he is pleased, he'll stand there with us. And if he's pleased, then he let us perish. But nothing changes. We know God. We know what He's like. We know what He has done. We know what He's able to do. We do not know what He may do or will do. But this we know, He's a righteous God. He's an unchanging God. And there's none rules but God. The whole book of Daniel, you see, in essence, is about the conflict. Whose God is God? It's not God or no God. It's which God rules. And the great testimony of that book is Jehovah rules over all. So the reality of sovereignty, what an encouragement. All the while He's encouraging these Christians. So these three things keep in your heads: the judgment of God, the importance of standing for Christ. Your individual witness matters when a whole culture collapses. And ultimately, the sovereignty of God. Let's come to the application. Firstly, do not allow the whole drift and direction of our culture to determine your position. Don't allow the whole drift and direction of our culture to determine your position. We know what happens when churches do that. When churches figure out their position in light of the prevailing direction of culture. Martin Lloyd Jones, preaching in a sermon, I think it was about 1947, he makes the point. He says, churches are taking their stand in relation to the culture in which they live. They see that the culture has got a fad for dances and dramatizations. The church says, well, we'll just do the same. When we marry, as it were, the spirit of the age, well, I'm afraid we've lost it. We've nothing to hand on to the next generation. This is where Noah and Lot are our examples. They did not have their position determined by the prevailing direction of the culture in which they lived. Their position was determined by their relationship to God. That was the thing that determined it. But Noah and Lot were righteous men. That's the ground on which they stood. It's wonderfully encouraging, isn't it? There is nothing new in a sense. It's all been done before. So all these things are written for your encouragement. Keep on standing for the crown rights of Christ. Secondly, do not be discouraged by the mess of our culture and society. And don't be discouraged by the confusion in contemporary Christianity either. But do not be discouraged by the mess our culture and society is in. Remember, Peter is thinking still in terms of verses 1 to 3. And while he has turned his whole attention to culture and society and what happened in the past and how these men stood, he's still thinking about Christians being faithful to Christ, even though the church may be swamped with false teachers and false teaching. And he's saying, don't you be discouraged. Just because everything is a mess, it seems. Don't throw up your hands in despair and say, the cause is lost. What are the terms of surrender? There are no terms of surrender. There is no surrendering. Not in this conflict. The whole point of verse 9 is to drive home the need for believers to be faithful and to persevere. If the Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptations, the Lord knows how to reserve the unjust on the day of judgment to be punished. Oh, how can you quit? How can you be discouraged? How can you throw in the towel? The conflict is only beginning. That's what we must say. It is only the start of it. I've been refreshing myself by reading the history of American Presbyterianism from 1701, I think it is, right through to whenever Nathan was kicked out for orthodoxy. And to see how often people, men and women, had to take a stand, even though it was unpopular. Did they say, it's an uphill struggle. What about? And we're only free of people. Where do we sign the surrender to? Not at all. There was no quitting. There was no being discouraged. Don't you be discouraged. Though the outlook may be bleak in your position in which you are taking a stand, whether in the public square or your calling or even in terms of the contemporary church, we must go on like Peter. As Peter went on, as Peter encourages us to go on, Peter tells us this is how you are to view things. When you're feeling discouraged, you stop and say, "My, is my situation as bad as Noah's? Is it?" He had to build that ark himself from scratch, day after day, on what he had to face. Is my situation as bad as Lot? I think I would prefer Noah to Lot, mind you, in terms of the circus. But there it is, there's Lot, poor old Lot being vexed day after day. The things that he saw and the things that he heard. Well, Lot survived. God kept him. And here he is, set before us as a shining example. Don't be discouraged. Don't ever be discouraged. The issue you see is not how bad are things, but who is following Noah and Lot. That's the question. Thirdly, the times we live in are sent by God as a test of his people, or at least of all who profess to be his people. Testing times. Well, this raises an interesting question. What is the evidence of the true Christian in testing times? Well, the old covenanters were good at setting all this out, but I haven't time to go through all that, but I recommend it to you. But I will leave you from this passage with these two marks. Firstly, faithful to your callings as Noah. There's a mark. In testing times, being faithful still. And secondly, repulsed at the moral corruption as Lot. There's the other mark. In testing times, Christians are known by these two marks. Being faithful like Noah. Being repulsed at corruption like Lot. In other words, they did not succumb to the prevailing winds and say, "Well, I know things are not great, but sure, there it is." Lot never accepted the culture he was in. Never accepted it. And then fourthly and finally, all that we learn, we must use as Christians to stand against false teachers and teaching. We must never drift away from the context. All that we learn, we must use as Christians to stand against false teachers and teaching. You have verses 1 to 3. It talks about false teachers, false teachings. Tells us, you will recall, it's a historic problem, it's not a new problem. Tells us there will be many, there will be popular false teachers and teachings. Tells us of the problems that will accrue as a result of all this false teaching. It is damnable. It will make merchandise of professing Christians. And they will be around for a long time before judgment brings them to a halt. Peter says, I have digressed deliberately, that you may be faithful, that you will not succumb to false teachings, that you will not be a follower of a false teacher. Remember, verse 10, they are under the judgment of God. Chiefly them that walk after the flesh and the lust of uncleanness and despise government. As I say, it's a summary of verses 1 to 3. Why should you side with these rascals when they're on the wrong side? Why should you side with them? Charles Augustus Briggs, C.A. Briggs. He was a heretic, but he had a great following amongst Presbyterians in his day. The real question of that period in time, just at the end of the 1800s, the great question was not how many followed Briggs down the path of heresy, but who was not going to go down that path. That was the question. Who wasn't? Who couldn't? Well, Hodge couldn't go down that path. That's why some of us have his books on our shelves. Warfield couldn't go down that path. And others. Peter says, you don't need to follow them. You don't need to be intimidated by them. For they're all going to be judged by God. And the Christian says, hallelujah. Thank God. Amen.